Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. Our first case this morning is United States v. Suarez. Lieutenant Colonel Esslinger, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant? Lieutenant Colonel White, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and honorable judges. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Todd Esslinger, and I, along with my co-counsel, Major Colin Hotard, represent the appellant in this case, Corporal Joseph Suarez.
Colonel Esslinger, can you just speak up? You know, some of us have, over time, have lost our...
Got it, sir. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Chief Judge, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
As Corporal Suarez was being handcuffed and arrested in front of his entire company, the battalion commander pointed at him and said, quote, "That's the Marine selling cocaine in my barracks," end quote. The sergeant major followed that up by saying, quote, "That piece of shit drug kingpin is selling drugs in your barracks, and no one has the nutsack to say anything about it," end quote. Trial defense counsel's guidance regarding this UCI, as well as his deficient advice that a conviction for attempted prostitution was a registrable offense when it is not, prejudiced Corporal Suarez by causing him to enter uninformed pleas of guilty. The lower court's decision should be reversed for 3 reasons. 1, the UCI did affect appellant's court-martial in that it caused Corporal Suarez to plead guilty and it deprived him of witnesses. The trial defense counsel's deficient performance was prejudicial. And lastly, Corporal Suarez did not waive review of the UCI issue. The moment the sergeant major and CO arrested Corporal Suarez in front of his entire company, berated him, and then challenged the entire company for not coming forward is the moment the cancer of UCI metastasized and infected everything having to do with this court-martial, to include the investigation, merits witnesses, sentencing witnesses, and members.
Well, we are dealing with a guilty plea here. So what more should this military judge have done, in your view, for the guilty plea to have been valid?
Okay, sir. So it sounds like you're switching to waiver at this point?
Yes.
All right. So I think we go directly to the military judge's colloquy, if that's what we're going to talk about, because that's the judge talking to Corporal Suarez about the waiver. So to set the stage for that colloquy, though, what we have to understand in the affidavit support is that the trial defense counsel has told Corporal Suarez at this point the issue is not waivable and it will be reviewed on appeal. So Corporal Suarez has heard this from his defense counsel, and now we go to the colloquy with the military judge. And this is going to Joint Appendix 552 is where we start this at. The military judge says, and they're talking about this waivable motions portion, the military judge says, so, certain motions are waived or given up if your defense counsel does not make the motion prior to entering your plea. That doesn't mean this motion, because they litigated this motion to conclusion before a guilty plea. The military judge does not explain the certain motions or what those are. The next sentence by the military judge is, some motions, however, such as motions to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, for example, could never be given up. So that's what Corporal Suarez is hearing. The motion, the first one she talked about, doesn't matter. The certain motions don't matter. And then it goes to, in particular, this is in the next sentence as well, in particular, do you understand that this term of your agreement may preclude this court or any appellate court from having the opportunity to determine if you're entitled to any relief based on these motions? Now, after that colloquy, there's a couple of questions that go back and forth about who initiated this, the other motions that can't be brought up now. But the military judge concludes with, knowing what your defense counsel and I have told you, do you want to give up making these motions in order to get the benefit of your plea agreement? And of course he's going to say yes, because the military judge just told him what he heard his trial defense counsel tell him. Can't be waived. Some can, some can't. Maybe this paragraph means that there will be appellate review, maybe not. And so this was not an intentional and knowing waiver of a right or privilege by Corporal Suarez.
So what should the military judge have said?
Well, when we're talking about the right to a fair trial free from adjudicative UCI, if the military judge, and there have been four judges at this point, two military judges making rulings on the UCI. This military judge, because there was a litigated UCI motion to completion, this military judge should have done a much deeper colloquy with Corporal Suarez to find out if he really understood what he was waiving. Because
But I'm looking for specifics here, because the military judge in many ways seemed to go through it in a textbook manner in terms of talking about, have you already discussed this with your counsel, explained it personally herself, talked about, did the defense initiate the waive all waivable motions, talked about entering into the pretrial agreement and what that would constitute, and even went so far as to say, did anyone force you into this plea agreement? And he said no. What more should the military judge have done here?
Well, I think I would suggest a deeper colloquy with Corporal Suarez. This was touching on the UCI and just asking, has anybody forced you into that? I don't believe gets to the very detailed question. If he would just ask him, he did ask him, she did ask him that his defense counsel had informed him of everything. And that's what Corporal Suarez was agreeing to, is that his trial defense counsel had informed him of all of these things. But we see in the affidavits that the trial defense counsel admits that he told Corporal Suarez that this would be an issue that would not be waived and reviewed at the appellate level. And that was important to Corporal Suarez as well, because that's stated in the affidavits as well.
But counsel, to go back to the Chief Judge's question, I'm looking at, because we're in the record, so I'm looking at JA0554, which you were reading from, where the military judge specifically calls out the motion to for unlawful command influence. So the question on JA0554, after asking all these other questions, the judge says there was a motion to dismiss for unlawful command influence, and she lists the other motions. And then she rounds that out with, do you understand that by this provision in your agreement, you're waiving your right to appellate review of these issues? So I'm with Chief. How much clearer does she need to be?
Well, I think much more clear. And I say that because if you go back to the very beginning of that colloquy, right after the waive all waivable motions, where the military judge is saying some motions can be waived, some motions could never be given up. And this paragraph may preclude this court. It's waffling back between a definite and a non-definite. And so I do think the military judge could have been clear with that.
Counsel, let's just assume for a moment that if everything that was waivable was waived. Then was this waivable? This UCI claim in this case, was it waivable?
For this case, I don't believe it was waivable, Your Honor, and that's because the rabid form of the UCI that occurred completely infected everything from the moment it happened, from the investigation, potential witnesses, sentencing witnesses, and even members. I don't think UCI in this form for this case could be waivable because it had such an impact on the case.
So why then would the government enter into, if we were to rule in a manner consistent with your position, then why would the government ever accept a guilty plea for UCI? And stated differently on the other side of the ledger, wouldn't it preclude a service member from getting the benefit of a plea if, in fact, everyone knew, hey, you can always appeal this up. You can pretend to waive it, but you can still appeal it up.
Well, I would say that this issue is similar to the speedy trial issue in Ms. Gala. This becomes a fundamental right that cannot be waived. When the UCI infects the court-martial at its core, as in Ms. Gala.
So this court has been dealing with UCI for 75 years.
Yes, sir.
Have we ever said that you can't waive UCI? Because the position you're taking right now is UCI can't be waived. It would seem odd that over 75 years of dealing with this issue, we never ruled in that way.
Well, this court has never said it cannot be waived, Your Honor. And I think that's what we're looking for clarity in this case. The Air Force has said, based on the Weisler ruling, that UCI and the adjudicative nature could never be waived. Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals is saying it can be waived knowingly. And so we are looking for guidance from this court saying whether or not it can be waived.
And you're cabining that to just adjudicative UCI?
That's correct,
okay.
Your Honor. So if we've answered the waiver issue, I'll go back to the UCI. When UCI is followed by a guilty plea for prejudice, the courts look to see if any UCI caused the appellant to plead guilty or if he was deprived of witnesses. Both are applicable in this case. The military judge in his ruling stated the effect of the UCI was that potential witnesses and members received a message that the accused was guilty and should be removed from the Marine Corps. And to cure that UCI, the military judge ordered the convening authority to send a directive to the Marines in the battalion, encouraging them to testify for Corporal Suarez and letting them know that it would be okay. The convening authority completely ignored that order from the military judge.
On that point, though, the government says that about 2 weeks passed, and then there was the guilty plea, and it was mooted by the guilty plea, such that there was no trial, and so it's true that no such instruction was given from the convening authority to potential witnesses, but then we never had a trial, so it was mooted. What's your response to the government's argument on that?
Yes, Your Honor. So actually, from the day the judge gave the order to the convening authority, he had 85 days to issue that. As this court says in Gore, appellant's negotiation of a pretrial agreement does not mean that he is not entitled to a fair trial, one where witnesses are permitted to testify on behalf of and in support of the appellant. There was no caveat in the military judge's order to the convening authority saying, unless we have a plea agreement, you're going to give this order to your Marines. Nothing like that happened. And the convening authority failed to take any steps. And we know that that UCI can be cured if we look at Rivers. Rivers shows us a template of what needs to happen or what can happen to cure the UCI. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thanks. Let me ask another question, which is that there seems to be a factual question about whether any potential witnesses were deterred. You say there were. Do we have any finding of fact, or do we have to send this back for Dubé hearing? I mean, it seems like a crucial fact. Likewise, there seems to be a crucial fact about whether he would have pleaded guilty if he hadn't gotten the wrong advice about sex offender registration. I mean, we're in a weird position here where we're trying to assess whether there's prejudice, there's conflicting views, and we're not in a position to find facts.
So I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, in that I think that the record has been developed enough that we do not need to send it back for a Dubé hearing. This trial is extremely similar to Firth and to Lee. And the Supreme Court of Lee, it had to deal with deportation. This is dealing with a registrable offense. We have two affidavits from trial defense counsel. We have another from the accused in this case. And not only that, the trial defense counsel is admitting to the deficient advice that he gave to Corporal Suarez, and Corporal Suarez is basically saying that same thing in his affidavit as well. I think what you may also be touching on is that in Lee and in Firth, very similar language, the court should not upset a plea solely because of post hoc assertions from a defendant. Firth said something very similar: standing alone, an appellant's post hoc assertion are not enough to establish prejudice. And we have more than that in this case, because it's not just Corporal Suarez submitting an affidavit. There are two more from his defense counsel that are basically admitting that what Corporal Suarez is saying in his affidavit are true. So we have a developed record that does not require a Dubé hearing.
But do we have any facts found that show that any potential witness was deterred?
And we do, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, where's the finding of fact on that? I mean, the military judge said it could have had that potential, but there was no finding that any specific person was, and in fact, wasn't the command investigation found the opposite?
So just to that last piece, Your Honor, I think the government makes a ginormous leap when we talk about nobody saying that they were afraid to testify for Corporal Suarez. If you look at the investigation and the investigating officer's comments, he didn't ask anybody about testifying for Corporal Suarez. I think the quote that the government uses that you're referencing is taken from a motion from the trial counsel at the trial level summarizing what the trial counsel thought about the investigation. And so no one in that investigation said they felt comfortable testifying for Corporal Suarez. We do have the affidavit, and to show you that people were discouraged, I think what we have to do is, if you look at the testimony from the 39A, Your Honor, I see that I'm down to 58 seconds. And
please proceed.
Okay. If you look at that testimony from starts at Joint Appendix 415, 416, and then 420 through 435. The first sergeant is talking about how he feels and the consequences to his career regarding the CO and the sergeant major. He says, quote, the sergeant major reminded him, the first sergeants, routinely, specifically, that the battalion commander had just worked at manpower and the monitors reported to him. He has a fear that his career and his next billet are going to be hanging in the balance. The next quote from him is the battalion commander reminded everyone of how many generals that he knew and had served with in the past. The military judge goes on to ask him, did you feel that you would not be able to reach out and help Corporal Suarez in any way? His response to that was, I felt like they would not like for me to do that. And then the judge goes into the command climate, saying, when would you say you no longer felt that way? The answer, honestly, sir, I still feel like those two still have connections. Second order effects of that, right? They're still around. We have evidence in the record that shows people would have been afraid to testify for Corporal Suarez without the command's action of sending a letter to Marines, letting them know that it was safe.
Okay. Judge Hardy?
Counsel, despite the ordering of the QPs in this case, is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim essentially a threshold claim? Because the UCI claim is in a guilty plea and the ineffective assistance of counsel goes to whether the guilty plea was entered sort of knowingly, do we have to resolve the IAC claim before we can even really consider the UCI claim?
I don't think that you do, Your Honor. I think that you can we would request that you answer the UCI claim first, because our request is that that's dismissal with prejudice for all charges. And then I think after that's answered, I don't think there's a requirement to answer the IAC first, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Colonel. Lieutenant Colonel White.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Candace White, and along with Colonel Ian Pennin, represent the United States. After appellant's public arrest, his commanding general took swift, decisive action to prohibit the commanding officer from any involvement in the case. He convened an investigation, subsequently relieved the commanding officer, and personally assumed authority over the case. Appellant raised and fully litigated the UCI motion, resulting in remedies from two military judges. Appellant abandoned those remedies when he chose to enter into an unconditional plea agreement, which expressly waived all waivable motions, a provision appellant himself originated. He later affirmatively waived further relief on that motion before entering pleas and agreed with the military judge's explanation of the effects of that waiver on his appeal. Despite all that, appellant now asks that this court overturn his conviction. This court should affirm the findings and sentence for three reasons. One, appellant affirmatively waived the issue of UCI in his unconditional bargain for plea agreement and on the record with the military judge. Two, unlawful command influence did not affect appellant's court-martial, at which he voluntarily pled guilty and presented good military character evidence. And three, appellant's trial defense counsel's performance did not prejudice appellant as he received a favorable plea agreement.
So when we have a case where UCI clearly is an issue, why shouldn't we be concerned that it was UCI itself that caused the accused to plead guilty and to waive that motion, that they were under duress?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that that's why the RCMs put the onus on military judges to ensure that the plea is knowing and voluntary. RCM 910 requires that the military judge conduct a direct and thorough colloquy. And the judge in this case did just that. She went through every single provision of the plea agreement, including the motions waiver, which Judge Johnson discussed with my colleague. And she also went further, and we also have the CARE inquiry, which is a further buttress to ensure that service members are knowingly and voluntarily pleading guilty and that they're aware of the offenses to which they're pleading. And in
the course of that inquiry, is there anything here there on the record in this particular case where there is a fleshing out of this concern that the accused is standing there saying, all of my witnesses have been scared off. There's no way to really cure that. I need to plead guilty because I need the benefit of that. And there's no cure for the UCI. How should the court view that? Should the court be concerned about the corrosive effect of UCI, even in the course of a very thorough CARE inquiry?
Yes, this court should be concerned, Your Honor, but in this particular case, the record doesn't support that those are the facts and circumstances. Contrary to appellant's argument, if you turn to page 413 of the joint appendix, who, by the way, was the only one out of the 55 Marines interviewed during the command investigation that expressed any trepidation whatsoever in participating in appellant's court-martial. When he testified during the motions hearing, the trial counsel specifically asked him, did he, meaning the commanding officer, tell anyone not to participate in accused court-martial? No, not to my knowledge, sir. Did he tell anyone not to provide the accused any character statements? No, sir. And then turning to 418 and 419 of the joint appendix, further testifies when asked if he would feel comfortable speaking favorably about Corporal Suarez. First Sergeant testifies that he would feel comfortable, he would not feel any retaliation, and specifically when asked, quote, if the defense were to ask you to testify for about Corporal Suarez being a good Marine, would you feel comfortable doing so? Answer, yes, sir. And he also answered affirmatively in response, do you think your junior Marines, your enlisted Marines and NCOs that were present in Classroom 7, do you think they would feel comfortable speaking? And he ultimately answers, yes, I think the Marines would speak honestly, sir. So the facts of this case, the record in this case, don't support that all the witnesses were scared off from participating in appellant's court-martial. But even if that were the case, that's why under RCM 910, the burden is on the military judge to ensure that the appellant is entering voluntary and knowing pleas of guilty. And it's supported again in the record by the fact that appellant is the one that proposed the plea agreement, including the waive all waivable motions provision. And the timeline in this case is very indicative. The UCI motion was originally litigated on June 28, 2002. It was denied on 14 July. The ruling was supplemented on 26 July, and then just a few days later, on 1 August, the military judge allowed argument on further untimely motions by appellant, and appellant did not raise any additional issues or concerns regarding this UCI motion. And then just 8 days after that 39A, appellant submitted a signed PTA. And then on 12 August, the CG signed the PTA. The original trial dates set by the TMO were 5 September, but the guilty plea was not actually conducted until 18 October. So appellant had from 12 August till 18 October to not only locate potential witnesses for his defense, but to re-raise the issue to the military judge if he felt that the UCI motion was not properly remedied. An appellant failed to do so here. And applying the standard in United States versus Douglas, this court held that when a military judge has fashioned a timely and appropriate remedy, it's on the appellant to say if that remedy is not adequate or has not been properly executed. An appellant was under the burden to do so with the military judge, and he not only chose not to raise such an issue, but he affirmatively stated on the record to the military judge that his plea was guilty and he was not having issues with his defense. And under U.S. v. Haynes, when we're talking about waiver, it can be by operation of law or an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right. And that's exactly what the appellant did in this case.
White, can I stop you there for just a minute? I'm curious about whether you have a view, given the somewhat unsettled nature of our jurisprudential landscape regarding the waiver of unlawful influence. And as I understand it, our cases seem to suggest sometimes you can't waive it, sometimes you can waive it, and there are a variety of factors in these cases. And I'm wondering what your view is. For instance, does a guilty plea make a difference in whether or not you can waive it, or is it only when the unlawful influence goes to a constitutional dimension, a specific like the selection of members, pressure on a military judge or something like that? Is that a factor? Is it in cases where it's either raised, like in this case, or not raised at all? There are a number of factors that seem to determine what particular case will be considered waiver or not waiver of an unlawful influence case. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that and thought about it and have a view.
Yes, Your Honor. The United States is not aware of any case that says either adjudicative or accusatory cannot be waived. It's more fact-specific. And I know the appellant cites Douglas for the proposition that adjudicative UCI cannot be waived, but the Douglas case was not about waiver because in that case specifically, the appellant raised and was actually successful on his UCI motion. But looking at the facts of this case, adjudicative in these circumstances can be waived and should be found by this court to be waivable because it was raised and litigated. The primary concerns with maybe a typical or more typical adjudicative UCI claim is that it's not discovered until after the adjudicative process is run. So after the findings, after the sentence, and then later it comes to light that, say, the members were influenced or there was something unfair about the proceedings due to the unlawful command influence. Here, the command influence was identified even prior to preferral, so it wasn't even the individual that remained as the commanding authority. The commanding general took the case from the commanding officer, took it upon himself as the commanding authority.
So you're suggesting that at least one of the factors from the government standpoint is when the unlawful influence occurs.
And when it's discovered,
Your Honor. Discovered, yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the only one, the only factor in deciding that this kind of motion or issue should be waived? Considered waived?
Not the only factors, Your Honor, but I believe in this case those would be the two primary factors to be considered, that it occurred prior to preferral and that it was addressed prior to preferral, and it was also able to be litigated in motions practice prior to any guilty plea colloquy, or say if it had gone to a contested trial, it would be prior to that.
Yeah, let me ask you another question that kind of goes back or relates to a question by Judge Hardy of your colleague, and that is, suppose, and just suppose, I'm characteristically in the dissent, so I might be by myself, but let's suppose the court agrees with you and says this is a waiver. I did not quite understand the answer to Judge Hardy's question by appellate defense counsel, not that it wasn't a clear answer. It's just that I didn't understand. But my question is, if the court decides that this is waiver, does that, what effect, if any, does that have on the issue of ineffective assistance, since the core of the ineffectiveness claim is the unlawful influence? I thought that's what Judge Hardy's question was getting at. I won't speak for him, but that's my question as it relates to his.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's why under the rules, specifically RCM 910, the burden lies on the military judge, not on defense counsel, to ensure that a guilty plea is knowing and voluntary. So even if this court were to find that there was IAC at some level and that maybe it did affect his consideration of whether or not to plead guilty, ultimately it's on the military judge who exercised her duties. And if you turn to page starting at 552 of the joint appendix, the military judge went through every specific provision of the plea agreement. She asked who initiated the waivable motions provision, and then in particular, if you look at page 553 of the joint appendix, she said, quote, in particular, do you understand that this term, meaning the waive all waivable motions term, may preclude this court or any appellate court from having the opportunity to determine if you're entitled to any relief upon these motions? And further down, did anyone force you to enter into the term of your agreement? So while defense counsel's advice is always a concern, and this court's precedent and the rules account for that, the onus, for a good reason, is on the military judge under the rules to ensure the waiver is knowing and voluntary. So even with defective advice from a defense counsel, we can still have a knowing and voluntary record. And in this case, there was the knowing voluntary waiver in the plea agreement, which appellant signed in August, but more importantly, in October, on the record under oath, in direct response to the military judge's question, the appellant again affirmatively waived his right to raise these motions again and to seek subsequent relief or appellate review.
Counsel, since we're talking about the IAC claim anyway, so one of the big facts in this case is that we have a guilty plea. And I think it's the government's position that even though the appellant never got the benefit of some of the rulings on his UCI claim, that's his own fault because he entered into agreement mooting the fact that he never got those remedies, so it doesn't matter. But the appellant entered into, at least the appellant claims that he entered into the plea agreement under the misunderstanding that he was getting this illusory benefit of avoiding sex offender registry. And that's not particularly surprising. We're seeing that all the time. We're seeing appellants plead guilty to and willingly accept dishonorable discharges and BCDs so that they can avoid being sex offenders. So if the principal benefit that he thought he was bargaining for when he entered into this plea agreement was illusory, and that's because his defense counsel gave him bad advice, why doesn't that undo the plea agreement and everything else? Which I agree complicates the UCI claim and everything else. But did he even agree? His claim is, oh, I would have never entered into this agreement. I might have bargained for something else. I might have bargained for some other benefit if I had known that the thing I thought I was bargaining for didn't exist.
Yes, Your Honor. And we would turn to United States versus Bradley. In that case, this court held that it was IAC for erroneously waiving a motion, and this court held that merely being entitled to relief on an erroneously waived motion does not by itself satisfy the prejudice analysis. Instead, appellant must show that if properly advised, it would have been rational to plead not guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. And then U.S. v. Ginn, citing Barker, says that a mere allegation that the defendant would have insisted on going to trial is insufficient. And the Ginn court looks at the Supreme Court case of Hill v. Lockhart, finding no prejudice, noting that nowhere does he state that he would have changed his plea in this case. His conclusory argument that prejudice is clear from his counsel's defective performance is legally inadequate. So in this situation, even if that advice from the trial defense counsel was defective, given the nature of the offenses, it was still not rational for appellant to plead not guilty.
I mean, are those cases and that argument, is that consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Lee? Because the Supreme Court in Lee said, yeah, his case was terrible. He had a character. He had no defense. The government's case was strong. But he cared about one thing, right? He really didn't want to get deported. Don't we have something similar here? He's got a terrible case. The government's case is strong. But he cares about not being a sex offender. And so he says, I would have done something different. I would have bargained for something different if I had known that I wasn't in any danger of being a sex offender. It seems very analogous to Lee to me. But how is this not controlled by Lee?
Your Honor, I think one is just the very nebulous nature of sex offender registration. It varies by jurisdiction, and it's very common that a defense counsel not know all the ins and outs of each jurisdiction's registration requirements, and typically will advise you may be required to register. But it's often seen that an appellant, even the potential or the thought of it, will make them willing to bargain to some other plea. But again, even with the charges that appellant pled to, the drug offenses, he still faced 30 years and only received 5 years. So this case is much similar to Bradley, Jin, and Hill, where appellant did receive a very favorable agreement, does not now claim that he would like to plead not guilty, and it's simply not rational that given that he received 5 years for a max of 30 for the pled offenses, that he would change his plea. So we just think that this case is much more in line with those cases as opposed to Lee, Your Honor. And turning just very briefly to Article 37 itself, under the new language of Article 37, the United States argues that Congress eliminated apparent UCI. The new language of Article 37 requires material prejudice to the substantial rights of the accused to warrant relief. The fact that that material prejudice is required means that there can no longer be a reliance on simply the specter of an influence on the court-martial. And here, the remedies were addressed to not only to actual UCI, but also to apparent UCI. So there's a potential.
But counsel, the judicially imposed remedies were never affected by the command. So the remedies that the convening authority imposed, well, let me answer this another way, ask this another way. Is it the government's position that this case involved both accusatorial and adjudicative UCI, or just accusatorial?
Your Honor, I see I'm running low on time.
Please.
Your Honor, adjudicative was primarily litigated at the lower levels, both at trial and the CCA. The United States felt it prudent to address both, given the fact that the events happened prior to preferral, but adjudicative was primarily the issue in this case.
Okay.
What's the government's position in regard to a debate hearing, going back and trying to figure out, consistent with, I think, the point that Judge Hardy was making about this issue of, when it comes to sex offender registration, that, when you've got the scales, that really weighs down here. What's the government's position about whether a debate hearing would be helpful to determine to what extent that really weighed into the decision-making here?
Yes, Your Honor, it is within this court's purview if they choose to do that. However, we don't find it's necessary because the record just simply doesn't reflect that anyone was deterred. The 55 Marines gave statements during the investigation that they did not have an issue with participating. The one Marine who did have trepidation testified under oath during the motions hearing that he was willing to speak if asked by defense, and he felt that the junior enlisted and NCOs would also be willing to speak. And the reality is, appellant's misconduct involved dozens of Marines across the island, so that should be considered when looking into why he wasn't able to find character witnesses, because a lot of them were either co-accused or were involved somehow in the misconduct themselves. So the military judge did not make any findings that were clearly erroneous. He issued remedies, albeit not all executed, but that is because the appellant rendered them moot by submitting the voluntary plea agreement to the commanding general. He had plenty of opportunity over 2 months with which to raise to the military judge that the remedies were not sufficient and that he was having issues in preparing his defense. He chose not to do so, and lastly affirmatively told the military judge that he was knowingly and voluntarily pleading guilty.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Colonel White.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Colonel?
This is directly from trial defense counsel's affidavit. In an attempt to protect the client, I advised him that it was prudent to accept the plea agreement that would limit sex offender registration. All three affidavits confirmed that trial defense counsel told him it was a registrable offense and that it was important for Corporal Suarez to not be a registered offender. The government has said that the command's actions were public.
Counsel, before you move on from that one, I think in the government's brief they say, but there's still a missing piece of the puzzle, which is that appellant never says specifically that he wouldn't have pleaded guilty but for that advice. In other words, he got the incorrect advice. But I think in the government's brief they say it's still missing any kind of statement from him saying, "I wouldn't have, I would have gone to trial, but for that advice."
This is from Corporal Suarez's affidavit, Joint Appendix 358. I was charged with prostitution, and I did not want to risk registering as a sex offender, as my defense counsel told me I would have to. I think that answers your question, Your Honor. The government was saying that the command's actions were public enough to cure the UCI. The record reflects, however, that the only people that got to read anything official about the CO being dismissed and relieved, the sergeant major being dismissed and relieved, they had a star or stars on their collar. The Marines at the ground level who were impacted by the UCI received nothing regarding the substantiating the CO's misconduct, the fact that he was fired, or most importantly, that it was okay to testify for Corporal Suarez. I would ask the court to look at his testimony at the 39A when he's talking about being willing to testify for Corporal Suarez. The government cites the testimony before the military judge's questions, and it is the military judge's questions to where he says he's still concerned. This is the case, and these are the issues that this court was created to guard against. We are asking for the findings and sentence to be set aside and for all charges to be dismissed with prejudice. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Colonel. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Court stands in recess until 10:30.